We got a minute. We still got a minute. The last mission. Yeah, it's a good story. So yeah, just
okay. I'll tell it real quick. Okay. Anyway, I this was my second Misty tour. Most of the Mistys were up there for 120 days because of the 28% high loss rates. But I finished my tour, and I could have gone back, but I said, "Darn it, I can't go back to busting trees and making monkeys deaf. I want to know where the action is up north." And so I begged and borrowed, and they let me do another Misty tour. And I was just finishing up that tour, and I was in one of my buddies that was flying his last mission. It was his champagne flight for his first tour. I was on my last tour. And so I said, "Hey, Chuck, why don't I go with you? You know, we're hometown guys, and I'll fly your last mission, and it'll be a nice article in the Orange Cove Times or something. Two local heroes fly last mission." So anyway, we took off, and our deal that was to go and try to improve it. We have in-country our fighters that are all trained to work troops in contact, really close proximity, and they have to be really accurate. And so if we could get those guys up into North Vietnam, we can improve our bombing accuracy, right? So that was the big test. So we went up that morning. We found an old truck sitting by itself and says, "Okay, there's our target. These guys will come up. They're weapons school graduates, the cream to the cream of fighter pilots, and they will just blow away this truck." And all three of them went down the chute, and they missed as bad as the F-4 Phantoms did most of the time. So right then, actually, our test was over. I mean, the test had failed, and we should have stopped everything. But I looked down there at that damn truck laughing at us. So they tried some high-angle strafe, and that never works. And so the truck was laughing, and we thought, "Well, we'll fix you." And so I was in the back seat, and Chuck came around like that, and he did a low-angle strafe pass. That means that you're going to open fire at about 50 foot above the ground with about a 1.5-degree glide slope for strafe. And I was looking over his shoulder, and he was right beside this car, so I could see monkeys up there. See what color their eyes were. Is that close? So anyway, the pipper came up real slow, and just when it got there, you bunt it just a little bit, and then you fire. And Chuck just blew the hell out of that truck, pieces and stuff, and we pulled up. Bam! And I looked in the mirror, and it was full of fire. We were burning like mad, so we pulled up a little bit and pulled it out of the afterburner, and the fire turned into white. But the basic was that we got hit in the forward fuselage tank, and it was gushing fuel out. As it went back afterburner, then it was a big, long flame. So now we had to make the decision really quick. Are we going to stay here and bail out of the jungle for a better chance of rescue, or take a huge chance and go over that coastal plain with all the farmers and stuff? There's no chance of rescue if you bail out to get to the water. So we decided we're going to go to the water. Easy decision, right? We go for it. So we're climbing out, blew all the tanks and everything, cleaned the wing, and we're climbing out like that. Now, pilots make judgments, and you see the coast up there, right, and it's coming, and you see the fuel gauge unwinding, you see the coast coming, and you see the thing unwinding, and you realize, NFW. There's no fine way we're going to make it. So the only thing left to do is maybe we can take some of that fuel and put it in our afterburner, and before it dumps overboard, and then we can accelerate and get to the coast. However, the conversation with all the other planes around, he says, "What if all that fuel is inside the engine compartment? If it's there and you light the afterburner, the whole damn tail of the airplane is going to blow off." But then I look down at the coastal plains, and remember I saw an F-105 pilot down there, and when the civilians got a hold of him, I came by as they were macheting and decapitating him. So I knew what our welcome was down there. And so he says, "Okay." So he gritted our teeth, and he says, "Okay, Chuck, light the burner." So I lit the burner, didn't blow up. How it ignited that big, long stream of fire. So there's three people coming out, and one of them was just burning like 700 feet of flame behind him. But then we realized that, hey, we're going to make it now. We're going really fast. We were going supersonic when the thing finally flamed out. Another thing that happened on the way out, we have a raw gear up there, and it tells you about AAA gun sight, radar control gun sights, SAM launches and stuff right up there, and it goes from warning with the rattlesnake sound of the Fansong radar, And I remembered later that that thing was screaming like mad, like a SAM launch. But you prioritize things. Normally, if that thing lights up, you split for the deck and get out of there. But if you're on fire heading for the ghost, that's a minor thing. And I asked the other guys in the flight about it. I said, do you remember that? The radar went up? Remember that? The guy says, yeah, I do remember that. He says, what'd you do? I turned it off. Anyway, for the first time, I finally realized that I was going to get out of this thing alive. I was going to get to go home and see my family and my young daughter. If you're a true warrior, if you want to do your job, you have to accept the fact that you're not going to make it out of this alive. And if you continually think that you're going to get out of this alive and try to preserve your own life when you're in combat, you're an ineffective warrior and you shouldn't be up there. So for all those 8 months, I figured that I was going to be a prisoner of war at the best, and I'd already accepted that. And all of a sudden, that moment thought, hey, look at the coast, and look how fast we're going. We're going to make it. And all of a sudden, the whole feeling changed inside. All I got to do is eject, get rescued, and I can go home to see my new baby.
Cool.
And that's what happened. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. I'm going to wrap it up and just say, do we still, to my producers, have time for a few questions? No, we really don't. All right. We do. I get a thumbs up over here. All right. Let's have just a couple quick questions today. Couple quick questions from the audience? Yes? No? All right. There's one right there, that young man.
Do you know why the... General didn't eject? Was he killed, or was there a problem with the ejection seat?
Okay, yeah, real quick, and that's an excellent question. Unfortunately, another thing that I never liked about the Phantom was its ejection system. The front canopy is bent down like that, and if you unlock it, it's trapped. You have to have two pneumatic plunger to put the leading edge up so you can get rid of it. You can unlock it, but the canopy's trapped. And in the F-4 Phantom ejection system, there's a cable that goes to the canopy. It's called a wishbone in the back here on the Martin Baker. And if that thing is not pulled, then the seat won't fire. And so what we surmised happened was that ground fire had destroyed that pneumatic system. And he probably was trying to eject, but he didn't know it, that when he was hit over North Vietnam, he either had to land the airplane or he was going to die. And that's how we surmise happened, that it destroyed the part of that complicated ejection system. By the way, about ejecting, if you know where that's going to happen to that jet in a handful of time, you don't want to be anywhere near it. And when you sit up straight and squeeze those ejection handles, I got to do it twice, squeeze those ejection handles, and that rocket fires and you're going out of that airplane. That is the smoothest, most wonderful ride you'll ever take in your life.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Dick, thank you.